Welcome to Diversity Discourse, the official podcast of Minority Business Entrepreneur Magazine. This is the space where we create meaningful conversations around supplier diversity, diverse business entrepreneurship, and diversity, equity, and inclusion with some of the industry's most engaging and successful entrepreneurs, thought leaders, and experts. Now, let's get started with today's episode.
Hello, family. It's Tanya Isley, publisher of MBE Magazine, and welcome to Diversity Discourse. Today, we are continuing our Beyond the Logo series with Brooke Foley, the CEO of Jane Agency, a boutique brand strategy firm and a certified WBE. In case you missed our previous episode, Brooke and I met during the NMSDC virtual conference a couple of years ago, and we partnered to create Beyond the Logo, which has been a content series of articles and webinars led by Jane Agency on brand strategy, clarity, positioning, and so much more. And in each article, Brooke and her team present real-world examples by talking to MWBEs just like you. If you missed any of these articles, you can always find them on our website at MBEMag.com. And I'm telling you, there's valuable information in each one of those articles that you can use in your business. So in this episode of our Beyond the Logo series, Brooke discusses measuring promise through impact, and she'll be joined by Mike Anguiano, CEO and founder of Supply Hive. They're going to talk more about measuring promise through impact. So I thank you all for joining our podcast today. I'm looking forward to this discussion, as I'm sure everyone else is. And Brooke, I'll hand things over to you.
Thanks, Tanya. As always, we are grateful to be working with MBE Magazine to build out not just your position promise, but every entrepreneur who looks to MBE Magazine to grow their scalable, repeatable, and dependable brand position and promise. Today, we're excited to talk about impact, both analytical, but also in creating a whole new pathway for Hispanic entrepreneurs looking to create an exit based on person and company promise. We're joined by Mike Anguiano, serial entrepreneur, CEO, and founder of Supply Hive, an MBE certified business. Mike has spent his career upholding his personal promise of accountability, which has translated into a mission to elevate the diverse supply chain through 99% accurate real-time data and feedback from buyers to suppliers. In this fourth installment article, we talk about analytics, which sets us up to deliver on the measurements of success. And success measures are what support our promise, proving that what we say we do is, in fact, what we have done many times over in the way we have. So let's jump in. Why Mike loves Dollar Shave Club. Mike, welcome to MBE Podcast, and let's just kick off with that.
So that's your first question to me?
That Why is the first Dollar question. Shave Club? Yes.
Okay. So Dollar Shave Club. So Dollar Shave, here's why I love Dollar Shave Club, right? So first of all, I love entrepreneurs for a bunch of different reasons. Most of us are just ridiculously crazy, right? Because why would you go through the brain damage, right, of starting multiple companies over and over and over again? But over the years, as I've started a number of companies, I've realized that, what I learned the other day is not always necessarily for what I need to do in the future. So as I think about Dollar Shave Club, I think that there are lessons for like every entrepreneur, including me. So the first thing that blows me away about Dollar Shave Club is it was started by a really young guy who had no background in the men's grooming space whatsoever. Right. And so as we think about entrepreneurship, and we think about all of these things, people always think that you need to have this big background. I always disagree. I think the most important thing is you have a young guy like who started this thing, and he just looked at this big market that was like shaving and just said, I think that the way that we currently do it today is dumb. And I think that I can do it better, even though I have no background in the space. So as I think about entrepreneurship, that is the first thing that I always look at, right? This guy just started a company with no background in the space. The second thing is he had no background in marketing either. So you're going to love this, Brooke, right? So no marketing background, but he was smart enough to pick, and you and I both talked about this, a great name, Dollar Shave Club. Dollar, it's cheap, right? He knows his audience. Dollar is cheap. Shave, I know what I'm buying. And club, I'm a young guy. I want to be part of a club. Everybody does, right? So he picks this great name, Dollar Shave Club, out of the blue, and that was his name. So clearly has a marketing flair. The third thing that he did, which was really is what took the company off and what entrepreneurs should always be thinking about, is he knew that he did not have a lot of money. So for a few thousand dollars and with a handheld camera, he had actually his friends hold the camera, and he shot a 2-minute commercial that was the funniest commercial I've ever seen. So as I think about young entrepreneurs, I think they're actually better at this than old guys like me, right? So young people are so used to branding themselves. What do I want to see on Insta? What do I want to see on whatever social media I have? I think about a Kardashian, right? She created a billion-dollar brand using a handheld camera. Well, he shot this commercial and he posted it. And when he posted it, the young guys probably smoking weed, drinking, hanging out, right? The young group, they went out and it went viral, right? It went completely viral. So they pushed this thing out to everybody. And so many people logged onto his site that it completely broke the site down. So again, lesson learned for a young entrepreneur is never wait until you're completely ready to blow things out and to get out into the marketplace. Go right now, break things, and you'll be able to figure it out later. So I love the fact that they did it. And then finally, this is the last two pieces of it. He realized in order to make this thing a big brand to compete, he had to raise money. He did. He raised a ridiculous amount of money because he broke the internet. And then finally, this is the good part of the story, he ended up selling it to Unilever for $3 billion. So this guy creates a brand from nothing, and in a handful of years, exits at a multi-billion dollar thing. So the thing that I always think about, again, as a business owner is, like, why didn't Gillette come up with this idea? Why didn't all of these big global conglomerates that are in the space come up with the Dollar Shave Club idea? It's because they think a certain way. They've been thinking about it forever for a long, like that in a certain way. And you have somebody who's young, has no background in the space that says, I think that I can do this thing better. But the most important thing is he just did it, right? He went out, he started the company, and he took it out the market. So again, lesson for all entrepreneurs, you don't always need to have all of the background in the space, number one. And number two, just get it out there really fast. And number three, always be thinking about how I'm going to turn this thing into money.
I love the part that he had a metric that was undeniable. He broke the internet, right?
Yeah.
It was so successful. Who cares about how successful it was? It was that the metric was he broke the internet. And so his impact was very clear. And so it made it far easier for him to raise money in the Oodles space versus what his original ask would have been.
Yeah. He also, again, we're talking about Dollar Shave Club, but the Dollar Shave Club analogy to me is for all entrepreneurs. I don't care what type of business you have. He also spoke to his target audience. He didn't worry about people who shave with a straight razor. That wasn't his target market, right? He didn't care about people who love shaving a certain way. He knew what his young target market was. It was young guys that wanted a cheap, fast way, and they didn't want to go to the stores. Blade showed up at my doorstep every 4 weeks. You're kidding me, right? For a cheap price. So the guy had everything figured out. So that's the reason why I love Dollar Shave Club.
I think one of the things also that was so successful about the actual original edit that they did is that he was enjoying himself. Oh. I think that's one of the hardest things about being an entrepreneur is when you cross that line of it becomes work versus something that you're passionate and just in the zone about. And he just was so in his zone. That was my observation, is that he just nailed being in the zone.
Yeah. So this is what you do for a living, right? And by the way, you've done this with me in the past, which is do you remember at one point we were practicing some presentation and for whatever reason, I was stiff, right? And we were talking about, all right, first of all, Brooke actually made me take off my tie, and I used to wear a suit every single day, but she goes, okay, now you're like, so you got me into my zone. And all of a sudden you're like, if you can't do this thing being you, you can't do it being somebody else. And that's what the guy did. He was just himself. He was funny, right? He was like, looked right at the camera. The guy was great. So again, good lesson learned.
Yeah. And I don't know if you feel the same way about this, because, and you probably saw this at CVM and even at some point in Supply Hive, where, you know, you start something and you build it and it creates a groundswell and then it takes on a life of its own. And if it isn't something that you love doing, you get into spaces and places that work for everyone else, but they don't work for you. And now you've become a mini version of Unilever, right?
Yeah.
He really did a good job of like staying that course until he was ready to go out. So that would be my next sort of like tie on to what you said, is just, you know, the gut check of, am I enjoying this is so core to personal promise, because as soon as you move out of that, it's really hard. And that leads to my next question, which you'll figure my method of madness out when we get there. But when you had to sit in front of your client for the first time, you did not enjoy the fact that your company had not delivered on your promise of 99% accuracy. Do you want to talk a little bit about what that, like how that happened and how you went from enjoying it to, hey, like, I don't love this moment, but I'm going to stick to who I am, so I still feel good about who I am on the way out.
Yeah. Yeah. So the first company that I started was CVM Solutions, and we were a tiny little company, and we really hadn't figured out much yet. Right. And like we said, sometimes you just have to go until you fake it till you make it. And so that's where we were. So in order to get our name out there, I actually told everybody that we had what we called a 99% data accuracy or money back guarantee, right? I did not know how we were going to do that, but I thought that would get people's attention, and it did, right? So all of a sudden people started saying, hey, if their data is not accurate, 99% guarantee. So we had a bunch of clients, and early on we got some groundswell in the investment space and the financial services space. Merrill Lynch became a client. So we were delivering data back to Merrill Lynch. And at the time, there was a guy named, well, he's still around, Bruce Perkins. He's not the supplier diversity professional there anymore, but he ran the program. He was well-recognized, well-known, and he kind of became somewhat of a mentor to me and to our company. Well, we delivered the Merrill Lynch data back to him, and it was so bad. Now, I used to try to check all of the data before it would go back, but then we started getting too many clients, and I couldn't do it. It was so bad, Bruce called me up and said, Mike, I need to talk to you. So we went through the data. We just did a terrible job. It was my fault. It was, you know, our whole team's fault. We just messed it up. So I said, Bruce, I'll come out there next week and I'll meet with you. I had our little accountant, actually it wasn't even an accountant, a bookkeeper, right? Write a check for 13 grand. And I went and made out to Merrill Lynch. I brought it to the meeting, and I showed up at the meeting and I slid the little check across and said, it was made out to Merrill Lynch, right? I mean, you can imagine how much money they have. 13 grand, that's what they spend on, you know, lunch in an afternoon. So but first of all, I was unbelievably embarrassed that we had messed up so bad. Not even, it wasn't really because of that specific promise. It was the fact that we got sloppy, and I don't know when we got sloppy. It was personally embarrassing. And we were starting to get a groundswell of, I don't know, decent reputation. And you could see, there were three people across the table, and they were like, they were stunned. They were kind of shocked. They didn't, and they were like, absolutely not. We are not going to take a check from a minority owned company, right? That's not what we want, but we will help you. And they actually spent the next 6 months with us. I would fly out there with Bruce and his team, and they actually helped us fix the problem. So one of the things that, if I'm a diverse entrepreneur, right, there are lots of Bruce Perkins out there and teams of Bruce Perkins out there who are willing to help you. They know that you're not going to be perfect. I don't even think anybody expects you to be perfect. All they care about is that you're striving to be perfect for them, because they have a job to do too, right? Bruce went out to his boss and asked him for a certain amount of money for me, and then I had to go to his boss and say, I know I said this company was great, but they kind of screwed up. So I think that people appreciate sincerity. I think that they appreciate humility. And that is the way that supplier diversity professionals, in my opinion, can help all of us diverse suppliers. And I think that they work tirelessly to help all of us. And when we listen, and when we do a good job of listening and applying those, we all can get better.
And I like how you touched on actually three different promises right there. You touched and impact. So the impact of your personal promise, which came through in this notion of the personal guarantee, you upheld it. Like you went and faced the moment, right? You faced the music. You didn't shy away from it. The second part was your company's promise. You really demanded of your company to deliver back on that promise. And then the third of the diverse supply chain, which is set up to help diverse suppliers accelerate and elevate. Yep. And when those three promises are aligned, it's okay if things go bump in the night or they break or something, because everyone's focus is on fixing it or evolving it or even just honing it. Yep. And so much of the work that I see you doing now today in Supply Hive is about helping almost facilitate that conversation digitally and in person between suppliers and the buyers. And so do you want to talk a little bit about how you started to develop the intelligent community experience.
Sure, absolutely. So so the company that I referenced, CVM, so we, we had a 9-year journey. So I had that, from the time I started that company, we had 9 years. We ended up with about 350, mostly Fortune 1000 clients. He got a lot of them. And they were
just using for the sake of the listeners.
Oh, yeah.
So it's really clear.
Yeah.
You actually started, and I just want to make sure we're like clear about this.
Yeah.
You started CVM Solutions.
Yeah.
From a desk, actually, yeah. A table, right?
Yeah.
And so when you're talking about, when you're telling the story, you're a successful exit or so away from that already, but that still sits very in the forefront for you on an everyday basis. It comes up in talking to you about business, about solutions, about things that you're interested in. I hear you talk about it all the time. So I just wanted to make sure that for the listeners, that everybody understands, for whatever success Mike is at today, what he's about to share is very grounded in the hardcore realities of being a startup and an entrepreneur. Okay. And say whatever you want about that.
Yeah. So I sold that company, but that the selling of the company is just, that's the only thing that people see today, right? They don't see the, you know, 5 out of 6 days are really hard, and you know, you have more failures than you do. So entrepreneurs always think that they're alone and they're trying to struggle through these things. So as I look back, the advantage of having that experience was, first, I was a first time entrepreneur. So I had no idea what I was doing. I had an idea, but I had no idea how to build or scale a business. That's the first thing. The second thing I did, which I think in retrospect was smart, was I knew I didn't know much, if anything. So I found mentors who became investors. I really worked very closely with the NMSDC and the supplier diversity community, asking for the best way to do everything. How do I do this? How do I improve? How do I build the business? How do I do these things? I went to supplier development programs. I went to like talking Kellogg and others, right? So I was constantly striving to try to learn, right? And get better. So I think that leveraging those resources was really important. So you're right. I had that company for 9 years. We sold it. So as I knew I was going to try to, at some point after my non-compete was up, I knew I was going to try to go into my next business. And that's when the concept of Supply Hive came about, right? So all of a sudden I was taking everything that I knew from my CVM days and beginning to try to apply it to Supply Hive. So when I think about starting a company and I think about the CVM days, so I think that there are traps that multi-serial entrepreneurs fall into. The first thing that I realized is what got you there back then may not necessarily what gets you to the next level, right? So a lot of the things that I was doing worked really well way back in the day, but may not be relevant today. That's the first thing. The second thing is, You actually think things are going to be easier because people are going to listen to you and you're smarter today, but it's really not true, right? You have a little more experience. But the thing that I've also seen is sometimes your experiences can weigh you down as much as they help you, right? Because you're so focused, you know, in a specific area. So I really went into the next business and said, okay, in order for this thing to do well, I need to listen to the market. I need to listen to people. I need to ask people. But you also have to balance that out with an instinct. The market's not always right either, right? So your job as an entrepreneur is to see things that other people are not seeing and then apply intelligence and methodologies that you're learning from the rest of the world. So when I went into this business, I went out to all my old customers and said, what are the things that you wish you had that you didn't have today in procurement or supplier diversity? And the common theme that came back was, We have been developing our diverse suppliers forever, right? We've been doing it. We do a good job of it, but we don't do it fast enough. We don't do it at scale, and we don't have enough data to support the fact that diverse suppliers can and will and do outperform non-diverse suppliers on a consistent basis. So if you had some analytics and some data to do that, that would be fantastic. So that became the thesis for the business of Supply Hive, which basically started off as Yelp for suppliers, right? What, you know, how can I, if I work at Abbott, how can I log into this private platform and tell you what I think of my suppliers the same way that I do of my blueberry pancakes at IHOP or whatever, right? So that's where the business got started, something super simple, super easy, super fast. And then it began to evolve from there based on what customers really wanted. But The data that is coming out of what we're doing today, to me, if we continue down this path, will revolutionize supplier diversity and diverse suppliers for a number of years, not because we're smarter or doing something better, we're just doing something different. And we still have the superpowers of probably my favorite people in the world, and that's the supplier diversity professionals at all of these large corporations who work tirelessly to help all of us. I'm trying to enable them with information and data so that they can take it inside of the organization and use data to sell the narrative that they've been selling for a really long time.
And when one of the things that I have found so unbelievably powerful about Supply Hive overall, and I remember when it was an idea that was just Yelp for suppliers, and you were working through that, and we even talked at that time that you might be a few years too early for the market for people to be ready to receive that. But as I've watched it evolve, I could see making a strong argument. I'm interested in what you think about this. There's actually a question in this. I'm interested in what you think about the fact that by giving a fair and accurate review or accessible information about performance, that as everybody's struggling with the language of equity, that starts to provide something that really just creates a equal playing field for any supplier, not just diverse, which starts to really demonstrate very quickly your constant mantra, which is that diverse suppliers can and will outperform non-diverse suppliers given the opportunity.
Yeah. So, all right. So if you go back to when I first started pitching this thing, right? I didn't even have a PowerPoint. I had nothing. I just had meetings, but these were mostly people that I knew and said, okay, everybody would agree to at least one meeting with me, maybe not a second one. Early on when I was pitching it and presenting it, you'd see people tilting their heads. So either I wasn't sending the message the right way, or I didn't have the idea nailed, or maybe it was just too early. It's always easy to blame the market to say, oh, they just don't get it yet, right? That's the easiest thing to do is to blame somebody else. But I said, no, I need to dig in and get the message down. That's when you actually helped us to get our messaging down, right? To around the intelligent community experience. I began to formulate the pitch, right? The other thing that we talked about was I need to get the product into the hands of the users to start using it. So we started offering free versions of it to get people to test it and to break it. Dollar Shave Club, just use it and let's see what happens. So people started to do that. And then the third thing that I started to do was to try to find the thought leaders, if you will, right? Most people in corporate America are risk averse, and by the way, that's not a bad thing. Your job is to be somewhat risk averse for a large corporation. Your job is to protect the assets of the corporation. Your job is not really to help me. It's really not. It's about your shareholder value, not my shareholder value. So you have to come in with a very strong value proposition. But that said, there are certain people inside of these large corporations that are really thought leaders, right? They think more like Silicon Valley than they do somebody in Cincinnati, Ohio, right? So sometimes it's not the corporation that's advanced thinking. Sometimes it's an individual in the organization that's advanced thinking, right? One of the very first customers we had was a big old school company called Eaton in Cleveland, Ohio. And we just found this young woman who just wanted to go right through the glass ceiling inside of procurement. She actually came to us and said, I want to pitch this idea inside. I'm going to take you with me, not the other way around. And we found this brave, smart, strong, dominant female. And she just took us globally inside of Eaton, right? Even though other people didn't necessarily believe. So I think early on for an entrepreneur, finding that champion who's willing to go the extra mile is really important as well. So we were lucky enough to find that person at a bunch of corporations. And then what ends up happening is it doesn't matter what I say. It really doesn't matter what anybody else says. It matters what that woman at Eaton tells the person at Procter & Gamble. It matters what the person at McDonald's tells the person at Tyson. It's peer reviews, right? Are they any good? When we talk off the record, tell me how you like working with them. And I always say, it doesn't matter what I say, whatever that person says is always the truth, right? If they like working with you, if you're doing a good job in an off the record manner, whatever they say is the record, right? So I'm always thinking about that. What do people say when I'm not standing here, right? And I think about it all day, every day inside of Supply Hive and others.
So that I'm skipping questions here, but I wanted to know if Supply Hive has a Supply Hive account within Supply Hive for your company and clients to review you.
We do. We just finished one with a big pharma company. We were on the East Coast, and it had been a really lengthier, more complex project that had as many bumps in the road as it had good things. Like I was getting a little confident there. Like every new client was going pretty well, pretty smoothly. I was like, oh, look how smart we are. We have this thing figured out, right? And then we got a little bit more of we started to push ourselves to do more complex things. And it wasn't going so well. So the first thing that we did was we deployed Supply Hive, and we do this at all of our clients. And we ask, okay, how did we do? And then you watch the data come in, and then the AI parses through it, and it tells us something. And we're going, most of the time it's pretty good. And on this one, we got a rough one. And then the funny part is after we got things going, by the way, you don't do them once. It's all, what we do is almost like an employee performance review. You're not going to review your employees one time and then never do it again. I'm going to review them. They may not be doing so well, or they may be doing well in four areas, but there's one that I really need them to do better. And that's what Supply Hive does. It's the equivalent of the employee performance review, but for suppliers. But the important part is after I give you your review, what do I do next? Right? Because that's the ultimate goal. Big corporations depend on their suppliers to win in the marketplace so that if I can help them do better and help me do my job better, we all win. Right. So we do use Supply Hive. Now, I will admit early on, it broke a bunch of times. Right. But that's 4 years ago. So now we seem to be OK.
But that's the learning curve, right?
Learning curve. Never wait until you're perfect to get it out there.
Let me ask you one more question. How did you start and then use analytics to tell your investor story to secure funding? I think if I was a young entrepreneur right now who was looking for investment funding, that would be the biggest question. If I could sit down with Mike Anguiano, that would be the one question I'd want to ask. Like, how did you use that to get your funding?
Yeah, so we raised money this round. Our largest investor is Cleveland Avenue. Happens to be a minority-owned, Black-owned venture capital firm run by Don Thompson, former CEO of McDonald's. It's a billion-dollar fund. Jason Mercer happens to be on our board. So when you approach a billion-dollar fund with the fortune, with the former CEO of the biggest restaurant chain in America, the feel-good stories are fine. Obviously, everybody wants to see an entrepreneur with energy. They want to see an entrepreneur, right, that comes and they have a decent idea of how they're going to blow up a market. But somebody that is managing $1 billion needs data and they need analytics, no matter how rudimentary those data and analytics are or how early they are. The one thing that they are always looking at is a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, if this company were to scale or hopefully scale the way that we want it to scale, they have to be steeped in the analytics, right? They have to number one, are you tracking them? And number two, do you know what they mean? And number three, do you know what's good and what's bad, right? So even at the earliest stages, even if you don't have any metrics or analytics and you're pitching to an investor, make sure that you have a snapshot or a page that says, these will be the analytics that we will be measuring. These are the ones that matter. And your VC might disagree with you or say, we want you to track these, but the fact that they know that you are steeped in analytics makes a huge, brings a comfort level, because most entrepreneurs are first-time entrepreneurs. Most entrepreneurs are not necessarily steeped in analytics, but they want to see that you're thinking through them and that you know that they're important and you're not going to blow them off. So just think through the analytics. And by the way, if you've never raised money before, and the first time I went out, I had never raised money before, everything you need to present to an early stages investor is out there online. The 5, 6, 8, 10 things that they're looking for at the pre-seed stage, at the seed stage, at the Series A, it's fairly well defined. So you can just go out there, grab it and drop them into your deck. Everyone knows you did it. They don't care. They just want to know that you're paying attention.
So is there anything that I didn't ask that I should have about Supply Hive. I know people would probably really like to hear from you about the brand itself, but is there anything I didn't ask that you think that I should have?
Let's see. So we could talk about Supply Hive all day, every day. That's kind of my job, right? So that's the easy part. Okay, so I'll share a few things, but I don't want to just talk about Supply Hive. I want to make sure that we talk about it relative to what I think other entrepreneurs would care about and apply to their own businesses, right? So let's start here. So when I first came up with the idea for Supply Hive, I honestly did not know what the market would hold, right? I was like, I had this idea, supplier performance, Yelp for suppliers or whatever. And then what I started to do was I said, okay, I don't have any customers right now. I don't even want to ask anybody for money. So the first thing that we did, again, very controversial, not everybody agrees with this, but I ran free pilots with prospects for 1 year, right? Now I raised a little bit of money so that we can hire a couple of people, but the goal was twofold. One, get yourself in the door, right? So early on, if you don't have a reputation or if you don't have much of a product or you don't have anything, right, you need to do things that others are not willing to do. Even if they don't, I can't believe this is coming out of a business person's mouth, right? Even if they don't make you any money. So the advantage that we had from running those free pilots for one entire year, by the way, with huge companies, like I'm talking Coca-Cola and Walmart and other giant companies, was we learned what the business needed to be in a way that we never would have learned if we would have taken somebody's money and done what they wanted us to do, right? So the free pilots along the way were the thing that even today propelled us to where we were. So we learned what we needed to do. The second thing was
the research.
It was the research, right? And it was the research with real data, real information. We were talking to real prospects and real customers, right? And then the next year was and this is really fun, right? In 2021, right? We think about this. In 2021, you're starting to get a groundswell. You're starting to get customers and the world shuts down. So think about the world of supplier diversity in which we live. Trade shows went away, right? The primary way that we generated a lot of our inbound marketing or outbound marketing was through supplier diversity trade shows where we were able to go and pitch and present. So that went away for us, obviously, in 2021. We had to figure out a different way to get out into the market. And man, oh man, it was not easy, right? All of a sudden, you have to figure out a way to market and sell in a way that you've never marketed and sold. So here's what I did. I found young people. Right. And young people didn't have the trade show thing that I had built my entire business career on. They said, why don't you do it like this? Right. I talked to you. Right. You told me, why don't you try this? Why don't we try these different things as a new way to generate? So going, if all of a sudden you're in a world where you don't know what to do, go to others for advice. And I got the advice wide and vast. We've also talked about this concept of young people. Right. Everybody has the right. Right. So think about this.
Why do you like Gen Z so much?
Yeah. Why do I like to? I love Gen Z. You know why I love Gen Z? So I go to my Gen Z employees. I go to people outside of Gen Z and I go, OK, here's the way I do it. How would you do it? And more times than not, they go, well, the way you do it is dumb and slow and old. Right. They go, and here's the 10 times easier and faster way to do it. So people talk about Gen Z in some sort of a way or younger generations. To me, they're like my silver bullet sometimes. I go to them when I'm trying to find a better, faster, stronger way to do it. And I just apply my knowledge, my old knowledge to their new knowledge, right? And you just combine the two. It doesn't always work, but I mean, I love Gen Z. So as we've built up this business, the Gen Z group looks at us and says, hey, why don't we do it this way? And one of the things early on that we've talked about this is the use of machine learning and now artificial intelligence and combining the two. So younger people, this is not a big deal to them, right? So people at a certain point in the generation, they're nervous about this. They think that AI is going to take all of these jobs. But the reality is AI is just making your job easier, faster, and probably better. Will there be a few jobs that go away? Of course, there's every single 10 years, there are jobs that go away because of advancements in something, right? But guess what is created? A bunch of new jobs, right? Doing something else.
I get asked that question all the time too. And my attitude is, then it's time to go do something else. Go do something else. Like this isn't, it's an opportunity. It's not, something's not being taken away. Something's being given called time or options or new ways of thinking. It's very, I think it's so great.
So this is, so we use AI obviously inside of SupplyEye, but that's not the point here, right? So, but by the way, the only reason we use AI, this goes back to listening to customers. I was with a woman named Connie Savovich, who was the director of supplier diversity at Abbott. She had been there 30 years. So she knew the procurement organization. So they were the first pilot customer we ever had. So all of a sudden the reviews start pouring in. We're all jumping for joy. Confetti's flying. Like, we're like, hey, our first prospect, and things are going really well. So we sat down with Connie after like a few weeks, and I was so excited. I go, oh my gosh, my brilliant idea is about to take off. And Connie sat down and we were looking at everything on the screen, and she goes, hey, Mike, all of this is great, right? I have people from all over the world reviewing my diverse suppliers. And she looked at me, she goes, but do you really expect me to read all this shit? Sweet God, that was what she said. And I'm in the meeting and I'm looking at her, and I didn't even understand what she was talking about. So she said, you need to, she goes, you know, we're all of a certain age. She goes, remember Cliff's Notes? She goes, you need to take all of this data and create a Cliff's Notes version so that I can go to my procurement managers and hand them that and not all of this data. So we started to apply AI to all of the ratings and reviews. Oh, by the way, Brooke, guess what was in the Wall Street Journal last week? Amazon, 4 years after we started doing it, is now summarizing the product reviews 4 years later after we started doing it. So do we have a 4-year jump on Amazon? We don't compete with Amazon, but we started doing these things because customers told us to do these things several years ago. And now they're bearing fruit. So we've been working on this, for several years, and because we have a little bit of a head start on it. Now, let's be honest, AI can catch anything. It's really fast. People can catch up, but luckily we have a model. So AI, we love it. We've been using it a lot. Our customers don't know what to do. And then the last thing on AI that I'll say is for a diverse business. Okay, so this is what I believe. I believe that technology first and foremost and AI second or in there is the great equalizer for minority owned businesses. Today, a minority business with very little capital can start tonight. They can actually start their business tonight. They can do a lot of things for free that they couldn't otherwise do. They can get out to the market faster. They can market faster. They can do research faster, right? To me, minority businesses or diverse suppliers, diverse businesses that leverage AI the way that AI was meant to be leveraged becomes the great equalizer. You can create the next Dollar Shave Club. That may be a bad example to catch up with the Gillette. But if I'm a diverse supplier and I'm not leveraging AI to catch the big guys, you know the saying, right? The saying used to be the big will eat the small. That's not true anymore. Today, the fast will eat the slow. So if you're a fast, quick business and you are willing to change, you're willing to start, AI can get you there overnight. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to win every single time, but I would be leveraging these techniques, whether I'm brand new business or whether I've been in business for 20 or 30 years. It's very powerful.
So this is my final question.
Yeah.
And I left it for last specifically because it's very easy to listen to your entire podcast and make assumptions. But Can you talk a little bit about what it meant to be a Hispanic MBE moving into entrepreneurship and what the world looked like for you and what you think it means that you were able to create that successful exit?
Yeah, you know, my dad's Mexican, right? So the way I even got involved in it, it was really accidental more than it was anything. So I used to work for a company called Grainger. I happened to be on the diversity committee at Grainger, and my first diversity committee meeting, it was announced that Grainger lost a contract with the big three automakers because they didn't meet the supplier diversity requirements in the bid. I was getting my MBA from DePaul, wrote a little paper, got a B- on it, of course, right? And the question was, you know, how could we leverage the internet to increase the effectiveness of supplier diversity? It started off as a paper. So I quit my job like a dummy. I quit my job and went out to the market, right? So a Hispanic entrepreneur, a Hispanic guy at a company, part of the diversity committee, now starts a company committed now to helping supplier diversity professionals help diverse suppliers, right? But it was a brand new world for me. So as I went out to the market, I didn't realize that sometimes you can leverage being a certain ethnicity as a disadvantage. or you can leverage it as being an advantage, right? So I was the first kid in my college to go to school. So like my dad always said, you could either whine about it or we can do something about it. So when we went out, I simply said, okay, certification to me is an advantage, not a disadvantage. I said, where it matters, I will make sure that I participate in all diversity events as a Hispanic. I did not try to hide it. I don't know why I would, right? I used it as something that could be an advantage when I needed it to be an advantage, right? So I would be part of MBE magazine, right? And on all of these things. So I tried very hard to figure out how to leverage it as an advantage. The other thing that I'm a big believer in, I'm around the diversity space, right? Why would I go to a party where people didn't want me in the party? I just started going to the parties where people wanted me, right? I would go to the NMSDC, right? And I would go to all of the local events. You know why? Because people wanted to talk to me. They wanted to see me. Being Hispanic in those rooms was a distinct advantage for me, whether anybody likes it or not. Then at some point, I was still a Hispanic entrepreneur, but I was able to go to different parties, right? So all of a sudden I was able to go to parties where maybe there weren't so many people like me, right? Maybe there weren't so many people that were in the diversity space or whatever. But early on, it wasn't something that was natural, but then I figured out how to use it and leverage it. And when I say use it, I don't mean use it in a bad way. The reality is, Brooke, we all know this. Businesses forever have created advantages that the other companies don't have. Sometimes they're made up and sometimes they're not. So what I tell every entrepreneur is, who cares what every sliver of advantage you have? Figure out every little piece of advantage you have and leverage it in the market. It doesn't mean you're always going to win, but there are a lot of smart people, a lot of good companies, a lot of well-funded companies on. So I leverage being Hispanic as one of those, and I'm very proud of it. Very proud of it. And by the way, we're still certified as an NMSDC certified company. So no, I don't know. I've used it and leveraged it, and I'm proud of it.
I think that's amazing. And as you know, we're all about leveraging the certification and the advantages that others call disadvantage.
Yeah.
So it's been amazing having you on here. Your vibrancy and the joy you have in the businesses you've built and the stories that you have are fantastic. Take one last second to let people know how they can find you for Supply Hive, and we'll make sure we reinforce it.
Go to supplyhive.com, SUPPLYHIVE.com. And when you see the fancy little B logo up in the top and you see the Supply Hive name, Jane Agency is responsible for that intellectual property, including the intelligent community experience that we still use. So thanks to Jane Agency.
That was awesome. Thank you.
You are welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Diversity Discourse, the official podcast of Minority Business Entrepreneur Magazine. We hope you enjoyed it. Please be sure to subscribe so that we can join you again. For more tips and notes from the show, check us out at mbemag.com. And to find out which guests and topics we'll be discussing next, sign up for our newsletter at mbemag.com/pulse. That's mbemag.com/pulse. We'll talk to you next time.